VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to the Game Podcast. I'm Gabriel Marcotti, and this week, because it's International Week, we've got a special lineup of guests. It's Alison Rudd, it's Graham Spears, and making his debut, it's Julien Laurens from the newspaper Le Parisien, which I'm sure you all read regularly. Today, we'll be reviewing England's victory over Wales and Brazil's win over Scotland. And also, we'll be discussing the changing relationship between fans and players. So please stick with us for the next 35 minutes or so. Well, it's everybody's favorite week of the year, International Week, where, as our good friend Tony Evans likes to say, there's no football. But, of course, there was football. Wales against England. I got to start with this. Is the result matters qualification nearly wrapped up? Shall we start with the most English person here, Alison?
Does the result matter? Of course,
is that what matters most? And
well, that was the question beforehand. The build up was, I think, people suspected, especially with no Gareth Bale, that England would probably get the result. So the question was, is it incumbent upon England and the managerial team to try and make people fall back in love with the team? A constant reminder that we haven't quite forgiven them for the World Cup, and not necessarily the results in the World Cup, but the way they played. And do England have to win us back by not just getting the points in Cardiff, but showing some sort of flair and great organisational ability and great picks and positions? And to some degree, I think they didn't. It was only the goals came very quickly, and then what happened? Why didn't England then press on and completely shatter the Welsh? They could have done if they'd wanted to. They seemed quite content with 2-0. I found it almost vaguely ludicrous that it started so well and then they didn't press on. Because imagine what that would have done for how the squad would feel had they won 6-0 and scored some really, really lovely goals and played some lovely football. Imagine what that would have done. Instead, everyone's still a bit sort of, oh, well, you know, is Scott Parker, would he be that good against a good team? And, you know, is Jack Wilshere being overrated? So you come out of it with more negativity than you should for a 2-0 victory.
Julien, following Alison's opening monologue there, first of all, I want to get something out of the way here. Okay, I come from a culture where if you've won the game, you've won the game. Whether you win 2-0, 5-0, it's about how dominant you look on the day, not about how many goals you can score. That's for children, although I do note that this weekend, Germany 3-0 up at halftime against Kazakhstan, they were booed by their own fans because they wanted to see more goals, more excitement, and so on, right? So I come at this, I disagree basically everything Alison said about that. Did you find the performance dominating enough, or would you have found it more dominating if they'd won 6-0 instead of 2?
Yeah, no, I agree with Alison. I was disappointed.
But you're wrong too.
Yeah, I know. But you know, France beat Luxembourg 2-0, and they were really poor. And in the paper the next day, it was exactly the same. It was like, well, yeah, we won, but we were really, really poor. And I think England were the same. They had no chances apart the two goals. They got lucky with the penalty. I mean, it was a penalty, but so early on in the game. after that, there was no way back for Wales anyway. And yes, you know, they did play high on the pitch. That 4-3-3 seemed to work okay. But, you know, in that Welsh team, the players are League One level, you know, Championship level. And some of them even, you know, someone like Joe Ledley was really poor and he played for Celtic.
Are you okay? Exactly. I got to agree with me, because he's basically implying that the average Welsh player is League One level, and James Collins and Aaron Ramsey and Danny Collins, they all thank you for that.
Except for the ones who aren't. And then he says,
one of them is even worse. He plays for Celtic.
Yeah, because I was disappointed by him so much. I really thought leaving Cardiff and snubbing some Premier League clubs to go to Celtic, I was very sceptical. And now I saw him playing yesterday, and I've watched him playing for Celtic as well. And I don't know if you agree with me, Graham, but to me, he hasn't improved whatsoever.
Yeah, Julian, don't worry, I caught the insult loud and clear about Scottish football. But you know what, I agree with you to a degree. There's been quite a lot of debate among Celtic fans about just how much substance Joe Ledley has got as a midfielder. Sometimes he seems one-paced, and I saw some of the adjectives that were used to describe his performance in Cardiff at the weekend, plodding and clumsy and this kind of thing. And I've seen him play like this for Celtic, and the more I've seen him, I think he can be a decent enough player. But for me, from what I've seen of Joe Ledley so far, he was not ready to step up into the English Premier League and play there. And I gather he was particularly poor at the weekend, but he's been... Well, let's say he's blown hot and cold for Celtic, and okay, they got him on a Bosman, so there was no transfer fee involved, but he'll be on good wages at Celtic. And from what we saw, for example, of the pre-injury Aaron Ramsey, Joe Ledley was not in that class, and I think he's still to show whether he can be a really good player for Celtic, never mind Wales.
I'm going to make you all say one nice thing about Wales before we finish this segment, just because it seems to be extremely unfair. And Julian, I believe you are married to a Welsh lady as well, which makes it even worse. I watched this game on television, and afterwards I saw Dicko's friend Gary Neville, and they were all talking about how, oh, look, how great England are playing 4-3-3 and not rigid 4-4-2. And rigid 4-4-2 is bad, and nobody plays rigid 4-4-2. And I just thought, like, A, like, did they learn the adjective, like, rigid, like, that morning, and they just want to use it as often as possible? But B, like, when we talk about tactics and we put, like, rigid in front of something, it's generally always bad, right? Alison, I mean, help me here. Like, rigid, bad, fluid, good, right?
I'm not sure there's such a thing as a rigid 4-4-2 anymore. Anyway, I mean,
you should tell Gary Neville.
Well, in the 18 years I've been writing the formation down when you watch a match, it's been a constant increase in the amount of time it has taken the press box to agree on what the formation is in that time, even if it is supposed to be 4-4-2. There'll always be someone that says, "Oh, but you know, I think that defender's holding, really, don't you think? Don't you think so?" And so I haven't seen a rigid, 4-4-2 at a reasonably high level anyway for quite a long time. And I think when people. I think that's what they mean when they say rigid 4-4-2. They're sort of harking back to maybe a time when people weren't so savvy about the fact you have to think about the fluidity of your formation. I mean, England weren't 4-3-3. They weren't 4-1-4-1. They were a mixture. They were a mixture of both at different times in the match.
You can go to a game and you can watch it, and in different papers you'll see different formations printed on the papers about the shape they played. You know, a 4-4-2 can very quickly become a 4-3-3 if so much as one of the wide players starts pushing up the pitch. You have things like Capello, for example, at the World Cup being panned for the way England played, and of course England were a dismal flop. Everybody recognises that. But was it the system, or was it flat players whose batteries were...
Julia, it seems to me also that, you know, I can play, say, 4-4-2 or 4-3-3, but if I have a very fast player who runs with his head down, maybe Aaron Lennon, out wide, the interpretation of that 4-4-2 is going to be different than if I have you know, say James Milner out wide, who maybe is you know, not as quick and will maybe cut inside or do different things.
Yeah, I agree with. I think it's all about the player's desire, movement, whatever system you play in, whatever tactical you try to put. Then it's all about if they want to, you know, a 4-4-2 could look brilliant. You could play very well in a 4-4-2 and you could play really poorly in a 4-3-3 or, you know, a 4-2-3-1, whatever. And I really think it's down to the player's desire, motivation, movement, you know, and how they link with each other more than where they play and if they switched on or if they don't or things like that. And I do think we talk too much in this country, in England, about tactics and how Capello plays and everything.
We talk too much about tactics in this country. Okay, I completely disagree with I just think we say the wrong things, but I want to talk about something else.
Go ahead. Ask you a question, Gab. What's the single greatest objection? It's become fashionable these days. What's the single greatest objection to playing 4-4-2?
It's that it's flat and you get outmanned in midfield because you only have two central midfielders and the other team normally has three.
Right. And what have the other teams playing 4-4-2?
Ah, so you'll be clever here. But that doesn't happen because everybody's being intelligent here in England and playing 4-3-3 or 4-5-1, you see.
I thought Capello just one game ago played 4-4-2 in Switzerland.
But that's international. I mean, that's a bit different. You thought you meant at club level. But generally, I think the main objection that everybody brings up is you're outmanned in midfield. And I think it's in England, particularly, because there's this perception that English central midfielders are not, you know, Xavi and Iniesta, what happens is they're not technically as good, so you need three of them so they don't keep losing the ball in the middle of the park.
Yeah.
And that's the conventional wisdom. I don't know to what degree I buy it. But
Alex McLeish's response to that is you play a narrow four. McLeish always says, so if you play 4-4-2, you don't play two wide men. You play a tight, narrow four. Anyway, let's not get bogged down in minutiae.
Obviously, McLeish and Ancelotti share a similar view on that one. Moving on from the English tactical debate to something even more interesting. How about the English captaincy? I've struggled until now to avoid mentioning this issue. But, okay, here's what I really don't get. I would hope that we all agree that the armband doesn't really matter and it only matters to the degree that it matters to the players and whatever. But what I don't understand here is why do Rio Ferdinand's people keep going on and on and on about this, and now it's so important that he called Steven Gerrard, but not him. I'm trying to understand, what does Rio gain from this? Obviously, he has some degree of sympathy from some people because his feelings were hurt that Capello didn't ring him or tell him personally or so on and whatever else. And I guess Franco Baldini's just a turd who doesn't matter because he's irrelevant because, you know, he broke the news to him or whatever. But I don't. What is Rio? And it is Rio Ferdinand's people and his lapdogs in our profession who keep going on and on and on about with this. And how does this help him? He already has all the sympathy, right?
Well, I don't. If they are going on and on and on, it's partly
a source called
Rio.
Rio's mate, Rio's friend, Rio's butcher. I mean, we all know who it is, right? Yeah, we all know who it is. And if it wasn't for the fact I get in trouble, I would start naming names right now.
Yeah, but Steven Gerrard doesn't let it out the bag that Capello was happy to use the telephone with him because Rio's people made him do it. I mean, a lot of information has been released because it would have been released anyway, regardless of how many camps Rio might have. But point that I'm going to answer your question. The question is, if they are going for it with the PR blitz, it's because Capello has tried to blame Rio, and that's the reason that they've got so angry.
He's already won the PR blitz, right? Because we have this notion here that the captaincy matters. We have this notion that you have to go and tell him to his face because Rio's going to be extremely heartbroken if the captaincy goes back to John Terry. I don't get. I mean, Graham, am I wrong here? Like, if Rio had just shut up, basically said, oh, I'm sorry, he didn't tell me. I'm sorry, I lost the captaincy. I think I should still be captain because I thought I was doing a pretty good job when I'm not injured. Wouldn't this just have knocked the whole thing on the head and would have all gone away rather than he didn't tell me face to face, he didn't call me, he didn't look for me in the director's box at Old Trafford?
I don't have any great sympathy, whether it's Terry or Rio Ferdinand or anyone else feeling insulted in that way. But Gab, for me, more important in all this is the near incompetence of Fabio Capello's communication skills. Now, I know this is a slightly different thing. This is a manager and a player having one-to-one relations, but the sheer incompetence of Capello, watching him repeatedly, trying to communicate in English, I just find him untrustworthy. I don't mean in terms of his honesty or veracity. I don't trust him in terms of the ability to communicate. And the guy at the heart of England cannot communicate. It amazes me.
Do you think he cares, Graham? I think because he knows when he's going to be leaving and he's had such a rough time.
Yeah.
I don't think he cares enough to communicate. If he cared, he'd have learned English better for a start.
Yeah, well, Alison, I agree with you totally. The other thing that's... Listen, I mean, I'm a non-linguist. I'm not knocking him for... I can't speak Italian. But the point is, his job is to be able to speak English, unlike me, so...
His job is not to be able to speak English. Come on, can we just all grow up here? His job is to be able to speak English. His job is to be able to deliver things with England. And you all thought that the sun was shining out of that place, right, when he was winning every game. And look, he's a disciplinarian, and this is what we needed to kick up the backside. And you'll all be saying the same things if he wins the European Championships in 2012, which, frankly, he might well do because, you know what, bad teams win the Euros all the time. And at the same time, England have some very, very good players, and that could be enough to lift you with a bit of luck to win the Euros. Now what? Now his main job is communication?
Yeah, that's absolute nonsense. Whoever heard of a situation where it wasn't important? It wasn't important for a football manager to be able to communicate with his players clearly. If you're saying that doesn't matter, I've never heard of such a scenario.
You haven't?
Key to a dressing room situation for a manager to be able to speak clearly to players. You're depicting a surreal picture for me. England in a World Cup, in a European Championship. They're in the dressing room. They're going out to a big game. The manager is not very good at relaying instructions to players. And in that key moment, you're saying, well, that's not really all that important.
No. Oh, Graham, we're saying two different things here. Right. I was answering Alison's point where I said the manager needs to be able to speak English, right? And I'm saying he needs to be able to relay key instructions to the players. I completely agree with you. And he needs to be able to communicate with them effectively within the context of the dressing room. That's a little bit different, though, than relaying things effectively to the media in the context of a press conference.
He's near to hopeless anyway. I know that.
Well, in his job interview, he said he would learn English.
And he said he would.
He didn't come in and say, I am such a disciplinarian that I don't need to learn English. You'll take what you're given. Right? He said he accepted at the start of the job he needed to learn. I sort of wonder, well, A, is he a bit thick? Because if you're living in a country and English isn't difficult to learn, he will have been exposed to English. It's not some obscure language like Korean. It's around. I mean, Julian speaks it very nicely indeed, and he's not English. And it is possible to learn English if you really want to. And if he'd really embraced the England job, he would be speaking English a lot better by now. I think already given up.
All right. Sorry, Wales fans. I was going to throw out the question whether it was difficult for Gary Speed to integrate people like Crofts and King and Morrison, guys from the lower divisions, alongside legitimate Premier League players, as Julian alluded to earlier. But we just don't have time for that. So I'm assuming it is difficult. And good luck to Gary Speed going forward. Why was Scotland against Brazil I was going to ask again why this game was being played at the Emirates instead of at Hampden. But we know why. I guess there's better corporate entertainment at the Emirates, and the promoters who run our game have basically decided it just simply is more lucrative for them to have it there. Is that about right?
Yeah, I think so, Gab. Yeah, I mean, they called it right in the sense that they knew that getting Scotland would get a mass invasion of fans, and they got that. I mean, you know, 53,000 for a friendly, 25,000 Scots. Okay, a lot of them already based in London, and yes, a lot of the Brazilian oblique South American community based in London, but they still, I reckon, maybe 20,000 Scots came down from north of the border. So in that sense, it was a winner. Well, it wasn't a winner on the pitch but for Scotland, but it was a corporate winner, as you say, and I bet you money was made. And in every sense, staging the circus worked, I think, financially.
Julian, the Emirates is your second home. Does it kind of bother you that they're playing this game there?
No, at all. I think it's a good thing.
Why did they play it at Wembley, actually? Or just because nobody wants to go to Wembley because it's a pain to get to?
Yeah, maybe not. I don't know. I think it's good. I think it's good to see. You know, it seemed like, Graham, you can confirm that it was a good atmosphere over there from what I saw.
Yeah, it was really good atmosphere, yeah.
Yeah, and it's a great stadium, great pitch. You know, yeah.
Graham, what would you make of Brazil? Because it strikes me that, you know, Mano Menezes, who, by the way, is on Twitter. I think he's on the national
team. Yeah, I saw that, Gab, yeah.
Yes. I think he might well be the only national team coach who's on Twitter.
A million and a half followers, is that right?
I think it's a lot, yeah. And again, there's a lot of Brazilians out there. To be fair, he's not like the most entertaining guy. He doesn't tell you what he's having for breakfast or what, you know, what music he's listening to just now. It's more like, you know, we got on the plane now. The team are very excited. We have landed. The team are still excited. It's more stuff like that. But it just struck me, he's got a big problem in the sense that he's got so much talent. In sort of, especially in the midfield and the striking positions, his defense seems to be slightly more veterans, a little more settled. But you don't necessarily have the outstanding individual sort of top five, top 10 player in the world type talent, although Neymar may yet get there. You just have a lot of very, very good players. And so sometimes it's difficult to find the right combination. Is that maybe the sense you got?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, Neymar looked terrific yesterday, but I'm like you. I'm always wary of making any emphatic judgment after 90 minutes, especially against Scotland. So probably not too much can be read into it. But if you were the Brazilian manager, you certainly have one hell of a lot of sifting to do through all the talent that comes through. But watching Brazil yesterday, I thought, well, here are these young guys like Neymar and others. But even in a friendly, I thought there was a real work ethic and intensity about them, which I found quite impressive.
Graham, who had the greater work ethic, Scotland or Brazil?
I would say Brazil, actually. Well, listen, in terms of willingness, Scotland were every bit as willing as Brazil. But put it this way, Brazil applied it more successfully. And for a guy like me...
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on. Settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Steeped in football, growing up in the 70s, loving football, what's now the myth of Brazil was just showmanship and a circus act. And to see them yesterday working so hard, even in a friendly, I thought was quite eye-opening. And it reminded me of what Craig Brown said Pereira had said, you know, years ago.
I think a lot of the reason you saw them working so hard is that, of course, they've got the Copa America coming up, and they know that, you know, there's basically maybe like 7 or 8 Brazilian players who are sure of going to the Copa America. There's so many spots up for grabs, and there aren't that many friendlies or training sessions where they can prove that. Interesting, too, also with Pereira, how all the stuff he told Craig Brown sort of seemed to go out the window in 2006 with Brazil at the World Cup. I just find it absolutely fascinating how this manager, who was so pragmatic in '94, became so sort of Keegan-esque in 2006. But I want to touch upon something else. A lot has been made about this in Brazil. I was on a Brazilian radio station, actually, ridiculously late last night, trying to explain this. Basically, Neymar feels that he was racially abused. He certainly was abused. I could hear it on television, people booing. And it's funny because, of course, when fans in Eastern Europe or Spain or Italy boo, they're making monkey noises. But when fans in this country do it, they're just booing. But somebody threw a banana on the pitch. You can see Lucas Leiva removing the banana. People are very upset about this in Brazil. People are saying, like, you know, you guys think you're the first world, but in reality, you're the people who need to grow up. Does that kind of sort of fairly sum up the background, Graham? I mean, you were there, you've written about it?
Yeah, it does. Yeah, you're right, Gab, that's the background to it. I mean, I'm not complacent about racism in football. God knows we see it often enough. And I'm certainly not complacent about the possibility of racism from the Tartan Army, even given the fact that the Tartan Army has such a good reputation and I think largely justified. However, having said that, I think Neymar just got it wrong. The Scotland fan, I was there, and the Scotland fans were booing him and jeering him because they thought he'd feigned injury and he was going down too easily.
Why would you feign injury in a friendly? It would never occur to me to boo him and think he was feigning injury in a meaningless, irrelevant friendly game. Is that really the reason they gave?
Absolutely, Gab. And I can tell you this: the Tartan Army don't give two tosses whether it's a friendly game or a championship game. They will boo and barrack any player.
No, I'm saying booing and barracking is fine.
Feigning injury.
To actually think, I'm all for booing the guy because he plays for the other team. But to boo him and then justify, like, we booed him because he thought he was being unsportsmanlike because he was feigning injury, it just sounds a bit... Why don't you just say, like, we were booing him because he played for the other team, he's a young guy, we thought he could get under his skin and maybe wouldn't play as well, and that's our way of supporting our team. Nothing wrong with that, right?
Right. Well, I mean, let me just finish the point. They were booing him because they thought he was feigning injury. I don't know, your view of a football fan's mentality might be different from mine, but the Tartan Army will boo any player they think is doing that, and they don't care what game it's in. Neymar has interpreted this as racism. Neymar walks off the park and he's booed and jeered by the Scotland fans, who I think, to the best of my knowledge, hardly have any racists among them. And he says, that must be racism. He just misinterpreted it.
Do you buy this? Is that a possibility that we really could have a lot of cross messages and a rogue banana here?
Yeah, I think maybe we're reading a bit too much into it. But because previously I think there've been stories like that. You know, in every country, in France, in Italy, in Spain, you know, there've been stories of racism in football. And I think I've been in England 6 years now, and I've never seen him before. And yesterday, you know, watching the game, he was shocked. I saw Lucas with the banana. It seems indeed that he came from a part of the stadium where there was more Brazilian fans than Scottish fans. And I heard the boos from the Scottish fans towards Neymar. I think there were more boos than monkey noses, and just that because he was a Brazilian player. And I think I'm feeling that we're reading a bit too much into it, and that actually maybe that was not really racism like we could experience it in other countries.
Does it count as a resurgence of racism if one person, even if it was a racist banana, sorry, I'm not making light of racism, but you know, bananas are yellow. I mean, someone might have just bought loads of bananas because Brazil were there, and if one person had shouted one sort of racist remark, it doesn't mean there's a resurgence of racism. And I suspect most people who were not Brazilian, who were at the Emirates, most people love Brazil in football. If you like your football, you love Brazil, you go to that game because you want not just to support Scotland, but you also think it's slightly a privilege to be able to travel not too far a distance. And even if you're in London, it's even more convenient. Just to see the mighty Brazil, it's a treat. You don't go there with a sense of tribalism because it's not how the Scots feel about Brazil in that way. There's more a case of mutual respect. Brazilians know that the Tartan Army have a reputation for being amongst the friendliest and most jovial of international football fans. It doesn't match at all. And even if that one person threw the banana, not as a joke, but forgetting that it might have had a significance, I don't even know why we're having the debate because coins are thrown and lasers are fired at players' heads all the time, and it's not regarded as a resurgence of anything.
For this next part of my debate, I have very, very strong views on, but I will keep silent because I imagine they will be rather unpopular. I was chatting to our producer, Chris, recently, and we were talking about the footballer John White from the 50s and 60s and how... Basically, players back then we're much, much closer to the average fan and to the average media. And part of this might have been financial. And my favorite stat here is that when Jimmy Hill broke the minimum wage, the maximum wage. We're so used to saying minimum wage. It's a very sad reflection of the times we live in. Here are some numbers, which, and I think money is part of it. At the time of the maximum wage, it was the equivalent, adjusted for inflation, of about £36,000 per year. And in 2001, the average annual Premier League salary was £676,000. And by some counts, it's now over £1 million a year. Julian, let's start with you, since you're far and away the wealthiest one here. Does money change things? I mean, you spend time with footballers also because they're foreigners in a foreign land and so on. Does it make it more removed, not from you because you're wealthy and you lead a flash lifestyle, but from the average fans?
Yeah, I can understand why the fans don't recognize themselves today in the players, because of the difference in terms of what footballers are earning and what the fans are earning, for example. I think I think the clubs don't do enough to interact fans and players. You know, I think and that's always and you probably agree because it's the same in your country, but in France, training sessions at big clubs like Marseille, PSG, any club actually, are open to the fans. The fans can come in the week, you know, watch training. At the end, sometimes they can take photos, sign autographs with the players and things like that. In this country,
So basically what you're describing, Paris Saint-Germain, Marseille, with the fans showing up, open training round, just like Old Trafford.
Just like Arsenal. And I think I really feel there's something the fans enjoy. They enjoy coming to training, see their idols, see the team's training, how they train, then grab an autograph, grab a photo, or see them leaving or whatever. In this country, you're not even allowed to come close to the training ground of United, Arsenal, Chelsea, or whatever.
I love it. Outside a lot of training grounds, they have those signs up, don't they, Alison, where they say, like, players are told, and the players will not stop for autographs.
Exactly. They will run over you with their car, with a Lamborghini, if you stand here to try to get an autograph. And I really think, this is a problem, for example. That...
Alison, when you were a little girl in the late 1980s, obviously, I think I'm not giving anything away here, that there is a top flight club that you support. Did you feel closer to the players? Did you admire them because they were maybe like your dad or your uncle, your cousin or your older sibling, or in other words, that you could relate to them directly? Or did you admire them because they were different, because they were sort of gods and royalty? Apart from Kenny, of course, who is the king, but I mean the other ones.
Well, both things are true, but when I was little, players still needed to earn a living when they'd finished playing, and it was in their interest to have a relationship with the community. They would open a sports shop or a pub or a restaurant in the vicinity, and their income would be guaranteed on the fact that they'd been fated as players but also seen as part of the community, and they were never too distant. I mean, there are you can find thousands of people who would be wandering around Anfield, and if you bumped into Bill Shankly, you couldn't get away. He wanted to talk, and that fed through to the players. Players were, if you spoke to them in the street, they were accessible. They'd stop the car and wind the window down and sign an autograph, whether it was outside the training ground or in the middle of the shopping precinct. Mm-hmm. And so it's not a fallacy to say it has completely changed. And overall, the top flight players are told not to do that, I think, because I think lower league players are still accessible. And again, if you bump into a lower division player, he will want to chat, because they don't feel they get very much exposure and their views are not heard, and they love the game and they love their club and they love the village near where they play, and they're happy to talk to you. But we have produced a breed of player who feel they're not human. They're packs of little deities all dotted around the country. You can't touch them. You can't touch them or talk to them.
Graham, if you could shed some light on this, because I would imagine part of the reason that players are told not to, or often advised to not mix as freely, is because maybe some of the supporters have become a little more fanatical over the years. Some of them are complete weirdos. And maybe in some cities, I'm thinking of your own fair town of Glasgow, there is a certain acrimony that is such that, you know, maybe it wouldn't be a good idea if, say, the Ian Ferguson of his day wandered into Baird's Bar and started talking to the people there.
Yeah, there are obvious pitfalls, I think, for modern footballers being out and about. It's a bit complicated, Gab, though, in a way, because in one way it seems to me supporters see and hear from footballers more than ever before, more than they did 30 or 40 years ago, for example, through the mass media, on television, newspaper interviews. In one sense, your average supporter has much greater access to a player than he had 40 years ago. So it is a little bit complicated. I mean, I know it's different because...
Sorry, Graham, just to jump in there. When you say greater access, does it mean because we know what his favourite colour is or his favourite band and we've seen him on, you know, MTV Cribs, we've seen his house and his garage? Do you mean like we just know more about them?
Yeah, well, however superficial it is, what I mean is a Man United supporter today hears much more, sees much more of, and hears much more from Wayne Rooney than a Man United supporter 35 years ago or 40 years ago heard from Bobby Charlton. Wayne Rooney is hardly a week goes by when he's not quoted or he's not seen in Match of the Day or he's not seen on television. This obviously doesn't apply to Sir Alex. But, you know, so in one way, supporters see much more of their players through the mass media we have now compared to 40 years ago. The difference is, for example, to use the Scottish context, when, for example, Rangers or Celtic went to play Aberdeen in a league game, they would arrive at the main train station in Glasgow and they'd go by train. And I don't know this for a fact, but I presume maybe if Spurs or West Ham played Man United 40 years ago, maybe they'd have gone by train. So supporters would get on trains in those days and see the team there, you know. You don't get that now, do you? But it's complicated. The players are much more visible. You could also argue that because of PR companies and other community initiatives, you could also conceivably argue that footballers do much more community work now than they did 40 years ago. So, to me, the picture's unclear. In some ways, there's not a distancing between the fan and the player. In some ways, there's actually a greater proximity.
Julien, did...
Just to say, but football has changed a lot as well, you know, since 40 years ago. And Arsenal went to play Manchester United in the FA Cup not long ago by train, like two weeks ago. They went to Manchester by train. But did they have
their own carriage like the Queen did?
Yeah, but you had to because otherwise the train would have never left Euston. Because if the Arsenal fans or anyone at London Euston station would have been able to get on the train to sign autographs or see the players or talk, the train would have never left. And in a way, football has become such a big, you know, business and it's such massive everywhere now that you have to protect the players in a way, you know, even sadly when they take the train.
The difference between fan and players augmented by the fact that they're generally not local lads anymore. They're you know, and I'm not just saying they're just foreigners who came here to take your jobs, but they may be people from other parts of the country or from south of the border, right?
I think that's probably a factor. I mean, as you well know, Gab, if you take the famous case of, you know, Celtic winning the European Cup in 67, all 11 players came from within 30 miles of Glasgow. You know, it was an amazing situation. And that one example of Celtic in 67 summed up the kind of localism that Alison was touching on. Now, of course, it's any team, even Rangers and Celtic, with their financial limitations, certainly in England, it's more cosmopolitan. I'm still not convinced, though, that it's as different as we make out. I mean, a Rangers player, a Celtic player, or a Man United player, or a Liverpool player steps out of the main door of their stadium, I think now, just like 40 years ago, a fan goes, oh, my God, you know, they're so-and-so. They're still that mythical, heroic thing there. Does the fact that... Is it really a key fact that now they earn 40 times what your average bloke in the street earns compared to back 40 years ago when it was maybe just twice as much or three times as much? Is it really such a big factor? I think that depends on the personality of the footballer. Some guys are flash with their gear, aren't they? And somebody else, like, take David Weir, now Rangers, once at Everton, he's completely level-headed. There's nothing flash about him at all. So there's all these different factors. I don't know if it's easily diagnosed, to be honest.
Julian, you get the last word. When I was growing up, one of my non-footballing heroes was Axl Rose, because I loved Guns N' Roses. I was never under the illusion that Axl Rose was going to be like anybody I knew. I accepted that he was different. He was a musician. He got to do other things. I liked his music, didn't necessarily want to be like him. Why can't we be like that with football? Why do we have to have this pretense that footballers can't be entertainers, stroke gods, stroke whatever? Why do we say, like, oh, but he's not a normal bloke? Or why do we even naturally say that when we meet a footballer who is just a normal guy, like, you know, it's somehow better than El Hadjouf, or the footballer who isn't a normal guy?
I don't know. I feel sometimes in this country that the fans love their football so much and love their club so much. They feel the players belong to them in a way, and that their clubs belong to them. And maybe 40 years ago or 30 years ago, you know, they could meet one in the street and say, oh, yeah, you know, I've had a chat with whoever. And today it's not even possible, unless maybe you live in Hampstead and, you know. But I do feel that the fans maybe expect, I don't know, too much off the pitch from the players, and that's wrong in a way. And I think maybe the fans are a bit to blame as well for that, you know, that gap between them and the players now that was not before.
Time now for some quick hits. Ledley King could reportedly be fit for the Spurs clash with Real Madrid in the Champions League on April 5th. Yes, I know we've all heard this before, but hey, maybe this time he really will play. Allison, should Redknapp even consider playing a guy who has not kicked a ball in a competitive game in more than 5 months?
Yeah, you should definitely consider it, because you're not going to outwit Jose Mourinho, but you might well baffle him by by playing somebody he's not been able to watch recently. I mean, central defence is the worst place to make a sudden a cameo performance, and it does defy logic to that extent. But I'm sure Redknapp has very good reasons for mooting it.
Yes, like confusing me, because William Gallus and Michael Dawson are just fine. Thank you. Fabio Capello has announced wholesale changes for the Ghana friendly this week, prompting the usual suspects to complain that fans who bought tickets are being shortchanged. Graham, do they have a point, or should they just grow up?
I think fans shouldn't be overly expectant on a friendly game. And it's all about competitive matches, and we've seen so many times before. I've seen it with Scotland, waifs and strays coming onto the scene for a friendly game. So accept the deal, that's how it is, don't cry, and move on.
Gerard Houllier is apparently turning the disciplinary screws on his Villa team. Julian, will it have any effect whatsoever? And is it true that Robert Pires gets chauffeured up from London every single day? And do you wonder which nice person at Villa leaked that to the press?
I think it'll have an effect, a negative one, because I think the players start to be really fed up by Gerard Houllier's disciplinary rules and as well these tactical ones. And then, yes, Robert Pires gets chauffeured, and I did that journey with him once, and it was lovely, and he's got a very comfortable car, and then he was still very good at training, so I don't think that was a problem. And I've got no idea who leaked it to the press, but it was not me.
Sounds like it was you. Gab, a question for you. Italy were a little disappointing at the World Cup.
Thank you.
Any signs of progress since then?
I think there have been signs of progress. What they're trying to do is, because the players aren't that good right now, the ones who are available, they're just trying to play better football. And they played Slovenia at the weekend, basically without a holding midfielder, and just with passing and movement. And Italy had like 70% possession, and they won 1-0 away. And, you know, are doing all the things that stereotypically Italy are supposedly not good at, and which we haven't been good at the end. It's a new route. It's a brave new dawn, but still, long, long way to go. That's all we've got time for this week. Thanks for listening. Please go to www.thetimes.co.uk. You'll find your news, your gossip, your analysis, and your web chats. I do mine on Mondays. Paddy's got one. Ollie K's got one. Spears has one. Well, you guys know the drill. But don't worry, we're going to be back next week. Till then, goodbye.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on. Settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books. Contacts. Calendar. Double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.